was sucked open and some plaster fell, but I knew that he was at the front of the house when the bomb fell. I went down the stairs. They were cluttered with rubbish and broken banisters, and the hall was in an awful mess. I didn't see Morris at first, and then I saw his arm coming out from under the door. I touched his hand. I could have sworn it was a dead hand. When two people have loved each other, they can't disguise the lack of tenderness in a kiss. And wouldn't I have recognized life if there was any of it left in touching his hand? I knew that if I took his hand and pulled it towards me, it would come away all by itself from under the door. Now, of course, I know that this was hysteria. I was cheated. He wasn't dead. Is one responsible for what one promises in hysteria, or what promises one breaks? I'm hysterical now, writing all this down, but there's not a single person anywhere to whom I can even say I'm unhappy, because they would ask me why, and the questions would begin, and I would break down. I mustn't break down, because I must protect Henry. Oh, to hell with Henry, to hell with Henry. I want somebody who'll accept the truth about me and doesn't need protection. If I'm a bitch and a fake, is there nobody who will love? A bitch and a fake. I knelt down on the floor. I was mad to do such a thing. I never even had to do it as a child. My parents never believed in prayer any more than I do. I hadn't any idea what to say. Morris was dead. Extinct. There wasn't such a thing as a soul. Even the half-happiness I gave him was drained out of him like blood. He would never have the chance to be happy again. With anybody, I thought. Somebody else could have loved him and made him happier than I could. But now he won't have that chance. I knelt and put my head on the bed and wished I could believe. Dear God, I said. Why, dear? Why, dear? Make me believe. I can't believe. Make me. I said, I'm a bitch and a fake and I hate myself. I can't do anything of myself. Make me believe. I shut my eyes tight and I pressed my nails into the palms of my hands until I could feel nothing but the pain, and I said, I will believe. Let him be alive and I will believe. Give him a chance. Let him have his happiness, do this, and I'll believe. But that wasn't enough. It doesn't hurt to believe. So I said, I love him, and I'll do anything if you'll make him alive. And I said, very slowly, I'll give him up forever. Only let him be alive with a chance. And I pressed and pressed, and I could feel the skin break. And I said, people can love without seeing each other, can't they? They love you all their lives without seeing you. And then he came in at the door. And he was alive. And I thought, now the agony of being without him starts. And I wished he was safely back dead again under the door. 9th of July, 1944. Caught the 8:30 with Henry. Empty first-class carriage, Henry read aloud the proceedings of the Royal Commission. Caught taxi at Paddington and dropped Henry at the ministry. Made him promise to be home tonight. Taxi man made mistake and drove me to the south side, past number 14. Door mended and front windows boarded. It's horrible feeling dead. One wants to feel alive again in any way. When I got to the north side, there were old letters that hadn't been forwarded, because I told them, forward nothing. Old book catalogues, old bills, a letter marked, urgent, please forward. I wanted to open it and see if I were alive still, but I tore it up with the catalogues. Chapter 3 10th of July, 1944. I thought, I shall not be breaking my promise if accidentally on the common I run into Morris. And so I went out after breakfast, and again after lunch, and again in the early evening, walking about and never seeing him. I couldn't stay out after 6 because Henry had guests for dinner. The speakers were there again, as they were in June, and the man with the spots was still attacking Christianity, and nobody was caring. I thought, If only he could convince me that you don't have to keep a promise to someone you don't believe in. That miracles don't happen. And I went and listened to him for a while. But all the time I was looking round in case Morris might come in sight. He talked about the date of the Gospels and how the earliest one wasn't written within 100 years of Christ being born. I had never realized they were as early as that, but I couldn't see that it mattered much when the legend began. And then he told us that Christ never claimed to be God in the Gospels. But was there such a man as Christ at all, and what do the Gospels matter anyway compared with this pain of waiting around and not seeing Morris? A woman with grey hair distributed little cards on which his name was printed, Richard Smythe, and his address in Cedar Road, and there was an invitation to anybody to come and talk to him in private. Some people refused to take the cards and walked away as though the woman was asking for a subscription, and others dropped them on the grass. I saw her pick some up, for economy's sake, I suppose. It seemed very sad. The horrible spots and talking about something nobody was interested in, and the cards dropped were like offers of friendship turned down. I put the card in my pocket and hoped he saw me do it. Sir William Malloch came to dinner. He was one of Lloyd George's advisers on national insurance, very old and important. Henry, of course, has nothing to do with pensions any longer, but he keeps an interest in the subject and likes to recall those days. Wasn't it widows' pensions he was working on when Morris and I had dinner for the first time and everything started? Henry began a long argument with Malloch, full of statistics about whether, if widows' pensions were raised another shilling, they would reach the same height as 10 years ago. They disagreed about the cost of living, and it was a very academic argument because they both said the country couldn't afford to raise them anyway. I had to talk to Henry's chief in the Ministry of Home Security, and I couldn't think of anything to talk about but the V1s. And I longed, suddenly, to tell everybody about coming downstairs and finding Morris buried. I wanted to say I was naked, of course, because I hadn't had time to dress. Would Sir William Malloch have even turned his head, or would Henry have heard? He has a wonderful knack of hearing nothing but the subject in hand, and the subject in hand at that moment was the cost of living index for 1943. I was naked, I wanted to say, because Morris and I had been making love all the evening. I looked at Henry's chief. He was a man called Dunstan. He had a broken nose, and his battered face looked like a potter's error, a rejected-for-export face. All he would do, I thought, was smile. He wouldn't be cross or indifferent. He would accept it as something that human beings did. I had a sense that I had only to make a move, and he would reply to it. I wondered, why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I escape from this desert, if only for half an hour? I haven't promised anything about strangers, only about Morris. I can't be alone for the rest of my life with Henry, nobody admiring me, nobody excited by me, listening to Henry talking to other people, fossilizing under the drip of conversation like that bowler hat in the Cheddar Caves. 15th of July, 1944. Had lunch with Dunstan at the Jardin des Gourmets. He said, 21st of July, 1944. Had drinks with Dunstan at home, while he waited for Henry. All went on to 22nd of July, 1944. Had dinner with Dee. He came home afterwards for another drink. But it didn't work. It didn't work. 23rd of July, 1944 to 30th of July, 1944. Dee telephoned. Said I was out. Started on tour with Henry. Civil defence in southern England. Conferences with chief wardens and borough engineers. Blast problems, deep shelter problems, the problem of pretending to be alive. Henry and I sleeping side by side, night after night, like figures on tombs. In the new reinforced shelter at Bigwell-on-Sea, the chief warden kissed me. Henry had gone ahead into the second chamber with the mayor and the engineer, and I stopped the warden, touching his arm and asking him a question about the steel bunks. something stupid about why there weren't double bunks for the married. I meant him to want to kiss me. He twisted me round against the bunk so that the metal made a line of pain across my back, and kissed me. Then he looked so astonished that I laughed and kissed him back. But nothing worked. Will it never work again? The mayor came back with Henry. He was saying, at a pinch we can find room for 200. That night, when Henry was at an official dinner, I asked Trunks to get me Morris's number. I lay on my bed, waiting for it to come through. I said, God, I've kept my promise for 6 weeks. I can't believe in you, I can't love you, but I've kept my promise. If I don't come alive again, I'm going to be a slut. Just a slut. I'm going to destroy myself, quite deliberately. Every year I'll be more used. Will you like that any better than if I break my promise? I'll be like those women in bars who laugh too much and have three men with them touching them without intimacy. I'm falling in pieces already. I kept the receiver tucked in my shoulder, and the exchange said, "We are ringing your number now." I said to God, "If he answers, I'll go back tomorrow." I knew exactly where the telephone stood beside his bed. Once I had knocked it down in my sleep, hitting out with my fist. A girl's voice said, "Hello?" And I nearly rang off. I had wanted Morris to be happy, but had I wanted him to find happiness quite so quickly? I felt a bit sick in the stomach until logic came to my aid and I made my brain argue with me. Why shouldn't he? You left him. You want him to be happy. I said, "Could I speak to Mr. Bendricks?" But everything had gone flat. Perhaps he wouldn't even want me to break my promise now. Perhaps he had found somebody who would stay with him, have meals with him, go with him to places, sleep with him night after night till it was sweet and customary. Answer his telephone for him. Then the voice said, "Mr. Bendricks isn't here. He's gone away for a few weeks. I've borrowed the flat." I rang off. At first I was happy, then I was miserable again. I didn't know where he was. We were not in touch. In the same desert, seeking the same water holes, perhaps, but out of sight, always alone. For it wouldn't be a desert if we were together. I said to God, "So that's it. I begin to believe in you, and if I believe in you, I shall hate you. I have free will to break my promise, haven't I? But I haven't the power to gain anything from breaking it. You let me telephone, but then you close the door in my face. You let me sin, but you take away the fruits of my sin. You let me try to escape with D, but you don't allow me to enjoy it. You make me drive love out, then you say there's no lust for you either. What do you expect me to do now, God? Where do I go from here?" When I was at school, I learned about a king. One of the Henrys, the one who had Becket murdered. And he swore, when he saw his birthplace burnt by his enemies, that because God had done that to him, because you have robbed me of the town I love most, the place where I was born and bred, I will rob you of that which you love most in me. Odd how I've remembered that prayer after 16 years. A king swore it on his horse 700 years ago, and I pray it now in a hotel room at Bigwell-on-Sea, Bigwell Regis. I'm going to rob you, God, of what you love most in me. I've never known the Lord's Prayer by heart, but I remember that one. Is it a prayer? Of what you love most in me. What do you love most? If I believed in you, I suppose I'd believe in the immortal soul, but is that what you love? Can you really see it there, under the skin? Even a god can't love something that doesn't exist. He can't love something he cannot see. When he looks at me, does he see something I can't see? It must be lovely if he's able to love it. That's asking me to believe too much. That there's anything lovely in me. I want men to admire me, but that's a trick you learn at school, a movement of the eyes, a tone of voice, a touch of the hand on the shoulder or the head. If they think you admire them, they will admire you because of your good taste, and when they admire you, you have an illusion for a moment that there's something to admire. All my life I've tried to live in that illusion, a soothing drug that allows me to forget that I'm a bitch and a fake. But what are you supposed to love, then, in the bitch and the fake? Where do you find that immortal soul they talked about? Where do you see this lovely thing in me, of all people? I can understand you can find it in Henry, my Henry, I mean. He's gentle and good and patient. You can find it in Morris, who thinks he hates and loves, loves all the time, even his enemies, but in this bitch and fake, where do you find anything to love? Tell me that, God, and I'll set about robbing you of it forever. How did the king keep his promise? I wish I could remember. I can remember nothing more about him than that he let the monks scourge him over the tomb of Becket. That doesn't sound like the answer. It must have happened before. Henry's away again tonight. If I go down into the bar and pick a man up and take him onto the beach and lie with him among the sand dunes, won't I be robbing you of what you love most? But it doesn't work. It doesn't work any longer. I can't hurt you if I don't get any pleasure from it. I might as well stick pins in myself like those people in the desert. The desert. I want to do something that I enjoy and that will hurt you. Otherwise, what is it but mortification? And that's like an expression of belief. And believe me, God, I don't believe in you yet. I don't believe in you yet. Chapter 4. 12th of September, 1944. Lunched at Peter Jones and bought a new lamp for Henry's study. A prim lunch, surrounded by other women. Not a man anywhere. It was like being part of a regiment. Almost a sense of peace. Afterwards went to a news cinema in Piccadilly and saw ruins in Normandy and the arrival of an American politician. Nothing to do till 7 when Henry would be back. Had a couple of drinks by myself. It was a mistake. Have I got to give up drinking, too? If I eliminate everything, how will I exist? I was somebody who loved Morris and went with men and enjoyed my drinks. What happens if you drop all the things that make you I? Henry came in. I could tell he was very pleased about something. He obviously wanted me to ask him what it was, but I wouldn't. So in the end he had to tell me. They are recommending me for an OBE. What's that? I asked. He was rather dashed that I didn't know. He explained that the next stage, in a year or two, when he was head of his department, would be a CBE, and after that, he said, when I retire, they'll probably give me a KBE. It's confusing, I said. Couldn't you stick to the same letters? Wouldn't you like to be Lady Miles? Henry said. And I thought angrily, all I want in the world is to be Mrs. Bendrix, and I've given up that hope forever. Lady Miles, who doesn't have a lover and doesn't drink, but talks to Sir William Malloch about pensions. Where would I be all that time? Last night I looked at Henry when he was asleep. So long as I was what the law considers the guilty party, I could watch him with affection, as though he were a child who needed my protection. Now I was what they called innocent. I was maddened continually by him. He had a secretary who sometimes rang him up at home. She would say, "Oh, Mrs. Miles, is H.M. in?" All the secretaries used those unbearable initials, not intimate but companionable. H.M., I thought, looking at him asleep. H.M., His Majesty, and His Majesty's consort. Sometimes, in his sleep, he smiled. A moderate, brief, civil servant smile, as much as to say, yes, very amusing, but now we'd better get on with the job, hadn't we? I said to him once, have you ever had an affair with a secretary? Affair? Love affair? No, of course not. What makes you think such a thing? I don't know, I just wondered. I've never loved any other woman, he said, and began to read the evening paper. I couldn't help wondering, is my husband so unattractive that no woman has ever wanted him? Except me, of course. I must have wanted him, in a way, once, but I've forgotten why, and I was too young to know what I was choosing. It's so unfair. While I loved Morris, I loved Henry. And now I'm what they call good. I don't love anyone at all. And you, least of all. Chapter 5. 8th of May, 1945. Went down to St. James's Park in the evening to watch them celebrate VE Day. It was very quiet beside the floodlit water between the Horse Guards and the palace. Nobody shouted or sang or got drunk. People sat in the grass in twos holding hands. I suppose they were happy because this was peace, and there were no more bombs. I said to Henry, I don't like the peace. I'm wondering where I shall be drafted from the Ministry of Home Security. Ministry of Information, I asked, trying to be interested. No, I wouldn't take it. It's full of temporary civil servants. How would you like the Home Office? Anything, Henry, that pleased you, I said. Then the royal family came out on the balcony and the crowd sang very decorously. They weren't leaders like Hitler, Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt. They were just a family who hadn't done any harm to anybody. I wanted Morris beside me. I wanted to begin again. I wanted to be one of a family, too. Very moving, isn't it? Henry said. Well, we can all sleep quiet at night now. As though we ever did anything else at night, but just sleep quiet. 10th of September, 1945. I have got to be sensible. 2 days ago, when I was clearing out my old bag, Henry suddenly gave me a new one as a peace present. It must have cost him a lot of money. I found a card saying, Richard Smythe, 16 Cedar Road, 4-6 daily for private advice. Anyone welcome. I thought, I've been pulled about for long enough. Now I'll take a different medicine. If he can persuade me that nothing happened, that my promise doesn't count, I'll write to Morris and ask him if he wants to go on again. Perhaps I'll even leave Henry, I don't know. But first, I've got to be sensible. I won't be hysterical any more, I'll be reasonable, so I went and rang the bell in Cedar Road. Now I'm trying to remember what happened. Miss Smythe made tea, and after tea she went and left me alone with her brother. He asked me what my difficulties were. I sat on a chintz sofa, and he sat on a rather hard chair with a cat on his lap. He stroked the cat, and he had beautiful hands, and I didn't like them. I almost liked the spots better, but he chose to sit showing me only his good cheek. I said, "Will you tell me why you are so certain there isn't a God?" He watched his own hands stroking the cat, and I felt sorry for him because he was proud of his hands. If his face hadn't been marked, perhaps he would have had no pride. "You've listened to me speaking on the common?" "Yes," I said. "I have to put things very simply there. To sting people into thinking for themselves. You've started thinking for yourself?" "I suppose so." "What church have you been brought up in?"
"None."
"So you aren't a Christian?"
"I may have been christened. It's a social convention, isn't it?"
"If you haven't any faith, why do you want my help?"
"Why indeed? I couldn't tell him about Morris under the door and my promise. Not yet I couldn't. And that wasn't the whole point for how many promises I've made and broken in a lifetime. Why did this promise stay like an ugly vase a friend has given and one waits for a maid to break it, and year after year she breaks the things one values and the ugly vase remains?" I had never really faced his question, and now he had to repeat it. I said, "I'm not sure that I don't believe, but I don't want to."
"Tell me," he said,
and because he forgot the beauty of his own hands and turned towards me, his ugly cheek forgetting himself in the desire to help, I found myself talking about that night, and the bomb falling, and the stupid vow.
"And you really believe," he said,
"that perhaps..."
"Yes."
"Think of the thousands of people all over the world praying now, and their prayers aren't answered. There were thousands of people dying in Palestine when Lazarus..."
"We don't believe that story, do we, you and I?"
he said with a kind of complicity. Of course not, but millions of people have. They must have thought it reasonable. People don't demand that a thing be reasonable if their emotions are touched. Lovers aren't reasonable, are they? Can you explain away love, too? I asked. Oh, yes, he said. The desire to possess in some, like avarice. In others, the desire to surrender. To lose the sense of responsibility, the wish to be admired. Sometimes just the wish to be able to talk, to unburden yourself to someone who won't be bored. The desire to find again a father or a mother, and of course, under it all, the biological motive. I thought, it's all true, but isn't there something over? I've dug up all that in myself, in Morris too, but still the spade hasn't touched rock. And the love of God? I asked him. It's all the same. Man made God in his own image, so it's natural he should love him. You know those distorting mirrors at fairs? Man's made a beautifying mirror, too, in which he sees himself lovely and powerful and just and wise. It's his idea of himself. He recognizes himself easier than in the distorting mirror, which only makes him laugh, but how he loves himself in the other. When he spoke of the distorting and beautifying mirrors, I couldn't remember what we were talking about for the thought of all those times since adolescence, when he had looked in mirrors and tried to make them beautifying and not distorting simply by the way he held his head. I wondered why he hadn't grown a beard long enough to hide the spots. Wouldn't the hair grow there? Or was it because he hated deception? I had an idea that he was a man who really loved the truth. But there was that word love again. And it was only too obvious into how many desires his love of truth could be split. A compensation for the injury of his birth, the desire for power, the wish to be admired all the more because the poor haunted face would never cause physical desire. I had an enormous wish to touch it with my hand, to comfort it with words of love as permanent as the wound. It was like when I saw Morris under the door. I wanted to pray, to offer up some inordinate sacrifice if only he could be healed. But now there was no sacrifice left for me to offer. My dear, he said, leave the idea of God out of this. It's just a question of your lover and your husband. Don't confuse the thing with phantoms. But how do I decide if there's no such thing as love? You have to decide what will be the happiest in the long run. Do you believe in happiness? I don't believe in any absolute. I thought the only happiness he ever gets is this. The idea that he can comfort, advise, help. The idea that he can be of use. It drives him every week onto the common to talk to people who move away, never asking questions, dropping his cards on the turf. How often does anybody really come as I have come today? I asked him, do you have many callers? No, he said. His love of truth was greater than his pride. He said, you are the first. For a very long time. It's been good to talk to you, I said. You've cleared my mind quite a lot. It was the only comfort one could give him, to feed his illusion. He said shyly, if you could spare the time, we could really start at the beginning and go to the root of things. I mean the philosophical arguments and the historical evidence. I suppose I must have made some evasive reply, for he went on, it's really important. We mustn't despise our enemies. They have a case. They have? It's not a sound one, except superficially. It's specious. He watched me with anxiety. I think he was wondering whether I was one of those who walked away. It seemed a little thing to ask when he said nervously, an hour a week? It would help you a great deal. And I thought, haven't I all of time now? I can read a book or go to a cinema, and I don't read the words or remember the pictures. Myself and my own misery drum in my ear and fill my eyes. For a minute this afternoon, I forgot them. Yes, I said. I'll come. It's good of you to spare the time, I said, shoveling all the hope I could into his lap, praying to the God he was promising to cure me of. Let me be of use to him. 2nd of October, 1945. It was very hot today, and it dripped with rain. So I went into the dark church at the corner of Park Road to sit down for a while. Henry was at home, and I didn't want to see him. I try to remember to be kind at breakfast, kind at lunch when he's home, kind at dinner, and sometimes I forget, and he's kind back. Two people being kind to each other for a lifetime. When I came in and sat down and looked around, I realized it was a Roman church full of plaster statues and bad art, realistic art. I hated the statues. The crucifix, all the emphasis on the human body. I was trying to escape from the human body and all it needed. I thought I could believe in some kind of God that bore no relation to ourselves, something vague, amorphous, cosmic, to which I had promised something and which had given me something in return, stretching out of the vague into the concrete human life like a powerful vapour moving among the chairs and walls. One day I too would become part of that vapour. I would escape myself forever. And then I came into that dark church in Park Road and saw the bodies standing around me on all the altars. The hideous plaster statues with their complacent faces, and I remembered that they believed in the resurrection of the body I wanted destroyed forever. I had done so much injury with this body. How could I want to preserve any of it for eternity? And suddenly I remembered a phrase of Richard's about human beings inventing doctrines to satisfy their desires, and I thought, how wrong he is. If I were to invent a doctrine, it would be that the body was never born again, that it rotted with last year's vermin. It's strange how the human mind swings back and forth from one extreme to another. Does truth lie at some point of the pendulum's swing, at a point where it never rests, not in the dull perpendicular mean where it dangles in the end like a windless flag, but at an angle nearer one extreme than another? If only a miracle could stop the pendulum at an angle of 60 degrees, one would believe the truth was there. Well, the pendulum swung today, and I thought, instead of my own body, of Morris's. I thought of certain lines life had put on his face, as personal as a line of his writing. I thought of a new scar on his shoulder that wouldn't have been there if once he hadn't tried to protect another man's body from a falling wall. He didn't tell me why he was in hospital those 3 days, Henry told me. That scar was part of his character as much as his jealousy, and so I thought, do I want that body to be vapour? Mine, yes, but his? And I knew I wanted that scar to exist through all eternity. But could my vapour love that scar? Then I began to want my body that I hated, but only because it could love that scar. We can love with our minds, but can we love only with our minds? Love extends itself all the time so that we can even love with our senseless nails. We love even with our clothes so that a sleeve can feel a sleeve. Richard's right, I thought. We have invented the resurrection of the body because we do need our own bodies. And immediately I admitted he was right, that this was a fairy tale we tell each other for comfort. I no longer felt any hate of those statues. They were like bad coloured pictures in Hans Andersen. They were like bad poetry, but somebody had needed to write them, somebody who wasn't so proud that he hid them rather than expose his foolishness. I walked up the church, looking at them, one after the other. In front of the worst of all, I don't know who she was, a middle-aged man was praying. He had put his bowler hat beside him, and in the bowler hat, wrapped in newspaper, were some sticks of celery. And of course, on the altar, there was a body too. Such a familiar body, more familiar than Morris's, that it had never struck me before as a body. With all the parts of a body, even the parts the loincloth concealed. I remembered one in a Spanish church I had visited with Henry, where the blood ran down in scarlet paint from the eyes and the hands. It had sickened me. Henry wanted me to admire the 12th-century pillars, but I was sick and I wanted to get out into the open air. I thought these people love cruelty. A vapour couldn't shock you with blood and cries. When I came out into the plaza, I said to Henry, I can't bear all these painted wounds. Henry, it was very reasonable. He's always reasonable. He said, of course, it's a very materialistic faith, a lot of magic. Is magic materialistic? I asked. Yes. Eye of Newton, toe of frog, finger of birth, strangled babe. You can't have anything more materialistic than that. In the Mass, they still believe in transubstantiation.
I knew all about that, but I had an idea that it had more or less died out at the Reformation, except for the poor, of course. Henry put me right. How often has Henry rearranged my muddled thoughts?
Materialism isn't only an attitude for the poor. He said some of the finest brains have been materialist, Pascal, Newman. So subtle in some directions, so crudely superstitious in others. One day we may know why. It may be a glandular deficiency. So today I looked at that material body on that material cross, and I wondered, how could the world have nailed a vapour there? A vapour, of course, felt no pain and no pleasure. It was only my superstition that imagined it could answer my prayers. Dear God, I had said. I should have said, dear vapour. I said, I hate you, but can one hate a vapour? I could hate that figure on the cross with its claim to my gratitude. I've suffered this for you, but a vapour. And yet Richard believed in less even than a vapour. He hated a fable. He fought against a fable. He took a fable seriously. I couldn't hate Hansel and Gretel. I couldn't hate their sugar house as he hated the legend of heaven. When I was a child, I could hate the wicked queen in Snow White, but Richard didn't hate his fairy tale devil. The devil didn't exist, and God didn't exist, but all his hatred was for the good fairy tale, not for the wicked one. Why? I looked up at that over-familiar body, stretched in imaginary pain, the head drooping like a man asleep. I thought, sometimes I've hated Morris, but would I have hated him if I hadn't loved him too? Oh God, if I could really hate you, what would that mean? Am I a materialist, after all? I wondered. Have I some glandular deficiency that I am so uninterested in the really important unsuperstitious things and causes, like the Charity Commission and the Index of Living and better calories for the working class? Am I materialist because I believe in the independent existence of that man with the bowler, the metal of the cross, these hands I can't pray with? Suppose God did exist. Suppose he was a body like that. What's wrong in believing that this body existed as much as mine? Could anybody love him or hate him if he hadn't got a body? I can't love a vapour that was Morris. That's coarse, that's beastly, that's materialist, I know, but why shouldn't I be beastly and coarse and materialist? I walked out of the church in a flaming rage and in defiance of Henry and all the reasonable and the detached. I did what I had seen people do in the Spanish churches. I dipped my finger in the so-called holy water and made a kind of cross on my forehead. Chapter 6. 10th of January, 1946. I couldn't stand the house tonight, so I walked out into the rain. I remembered the time when I had stuck my nails into my palms, and I didn't know it, but you moved in the pain. I said, let him be alive, not believing in you, and my disbelief made no difference to you. You took it into your love and accepted it, like an offering. And tonight the rain soaked through my coat and my clothes and into my skin, and I shivered with the cold. And it was for the first time as though I nearly loved you. I walked under your windows in the rain, and I wanted to wait under them all night, only to show that after all, I might learn to love. And I wasn't afraid of the desert any longer because you were there. I came back into the house, and there was Morris with Henry. It was the second time you had given him back, the first time I had hated you for it, and you'd taken my hate like you'd taken my disbelief into your love, keeping them to show me later, so that we could both laugh as I have sometimes laughed at Morris, saying, do you remember how stupid we were? Chapter 7. 18th of January, 1946. I was having lunch with Morris for the first time for 2 years. I had telephoned and asked him to meet me, and my bus got held up in traffic at Stockwell, and I was 10 minutes late. I felt the fear for a moment I had always felt in the old days that something would happen to spoil the day, that he would be angry with me. But I had no desire to get in first now with my anger. Like a lot of other things, the capacity for anger seems dead in me. I wanted to see him and ask him about Henry. Henry's been odd lately. It was strange of him to go out and drink in a pub with Morris. Henry only drinks at home or at his club. I thought he might have talked to Morris. Strange if he's worried about me. There's never been less cause for worry since we married first. But when I was with Morris, there didn't seem to be any other reason to be with him except to be with him. I found out nothing about Henry. Every now and then he tried to hurt me, and he succeeded because he was really hurting himself, and I can't bear to watch him hurting himself. Have I broken that old promise, lunching with Morris? A year ago I would have thought so, but I don't think so now. I was very literal in those days, because I was afraid, because I didn't know what it was all about, because I had no trust in love. We lunched at Rules, and I was happy just being with him. Only for a little, I was unhappy, saying goodbye above the grating. I thought he was going to kiss me again, and I longed for it. And then a fit of coughing took me, and the moment passed. I knew, as he walked away, he was thinking all kinds of untrue things, and he was hurt by them, and I was hurt because he was hurt. I wanted to cry, unobserved, and I went to the National Portrait Gallery, but it was Students' Day. There were too many people, so I went back to Maiden Lane and into the church that's always too dark to look at your neighbour. I sat there. It was quite empty except for me and for a little man who came in and prayed quietly in a pew behind. I remembered the first time I had been in one of those churches and how I had hated it. I didn't pray. I had prayed once too often. I said to God, as I might have said to my father, if I could ever have remembered having one, "Dear God, I'm tired." 3rd of February, 1946. Today I saw Morris, but he didn't see me. He was on his way to the Pontefract Arms, and I trailed behind him. I had spent an hour in Cedar Road, a long, dragging hour, trying to follow poor Richard's arguments and only getting from them a sense of inverted belief. Anyone be so serious, so argumentative about a legend? When I understood anything at all, it was some strange fact I didn't know that hardly seemed to me to help his case, like the evidence that there had been a man called Christ. I came out feeling tired and hopeless. I had gone to him to rid me of a superstition, but every time I went, his fanaticism fixed the superstition deeper. I was helping him, but he wasn't helping me. Or was he? For an hour I had hardly thought of Morris, but suddenly there he was, crossing the end of the street. I followed him all the way, keeping him in sight. So many times we had been together to the Pontefract Arms, I knew which bar he'd go to, what he'd order. Should I go in after him, I wondered, and order mine and see him turn and everything would start over again? The mornings would be full of hope because I could telephone him as soon as Henry left, and there would be evenings to look forward to when Henry warned me that he would be home late, and perhaps now I would leave Henry. I'd done my best. I had no money to bring Morris, and his books brought in little more than enough to keep himself, but on typing alone with me to help, we should save £50 a year. I don't fear poverty. Sometimes it's easier to cut your coat to fit the cloth than lie on the bed you've made. I stood at the door and watched him go up to the bar. If he turns round and sees me, I told God, I'll go in. But he didn't turn round. I began to walk home, but I couldn't keep him out of my mind. For nearly 2 years we had been strangers. I hadn't known what he was doing at any particular hour of the day, but now he was a stranger no longer because I knew, as in the old days, where he was. He would have one more beer, and then he would go back to the familiar room to write. The habits of his day were still the same, and I loved them as one loves an old coat. I felt protected by his habits. I never want strangeness. And I thought how happy I can make him, and how easily. I longed again to see him laugh with happiness. Henry was out. He had had a lunch engagement after the office, and he had telephoned to say that he wouldn't be home till 7. I would wait till 6:30, and then I would telephone Morris. I would say, I'm coming for tonight, and all the other nights. I'm tired of being without you. I would pack the large blue suitcase and the small brown one. I would take enough clothes for a month's holiday. Henry was civilized, and by the end of a month the legal aspects would have been settled, the immediate bitterness would be over, and anything else I needed from the house could be fetched at leisure. There wouldn't be much bitterness. It wasn't as though we were still lovers. Marriage had become friendship, and the friendship, after a little, could go on the same as before. Suddenly I felt free and happy. I'm not going to worry about you any more, I said to God as I walked across the common, whether you exist or whether you don't exist, whether you gave Morris a second chance or whether I imagined everything. Perhaps this is the second chance I asked for him. I'm going to make him happy. That's my second vow, God, and stop me if you can. Stop me if you can. I went upstairs to my room and I began to write to Henry. Darling Henry, I wrote. But that sounded hypocritical. Dearest was a lie, and so it had to be like an acquaintance. Dear Henry. So, dear Henry, I wrote, I'm afraid this will be rather a shock to you. But for the last 5 years I've been in love with Morris Bendrix. For 2 years, nearly, we haven't seen each other, or written. But it doesn't work. I can't live happily without him, so I've gone away. I know I haven't been much of a wife for a long time, and I haven't been a mistress at all since June 1944, so everyone's the worst off all round. I thought once that I could just have this love affair, and that it would peter slowly and contentedly out. But it hasn't worked that way. I love Morris more than I did in 1939. I've been childish, I suppose. But now I realize that sooner or later one has to choose, or one makes a mess in all directions. Goodbye. God bless you. I crossed out God bless you very deeply so that it couldn't be read. It sounded smug, and anyway, Henry doesn't believe in God. Then I wanted to put love, but the word sounded unsuitable, although I knew it was true. I do love Henry, in my shabby way. I put the letter in an envelope and marked it very personal. I thought that would warn Henry not to open it in anybody's presence, for he might bring home a friend, and I didn't want his pride hurt. I pulled out the suitcase and began to pack, and then I suddenly thought, where did I put the letter? I found it at once, but then I thought, suppose in my hurry I forget to put it in the hall, and Henry waits and waits for me to come home, so I carried it downstairs to put it in the hall. My packing was nearly done, only an evening dress to fold, and Henry wasn't due for another 30 minutes. I had just put the letter on the hall table on top of the afternoon's post when I heard a key in the door. I snatched it up again, I don't know why, and then Henry came in. He looked ill and harassed. He said, "Oh, you're here," and walked straight by me and into his study. I waited for a moment, and then I followed. I thought, I'll have to give him the letter now. It's going to need more courage. When I opened the door, I saw him sitting in his chair by the fire he hadn't bothered to light, and he was crying. "What is it, Henry?" I asked him. He said, "Nothing. I've got a bad headache, that's all." I lit the fire for him. I said, "I'll get you some Vegenin." "Don't bother," he said. "It's better already." "What sort of day have you had?" "Oh, much the same as usual. A bit tiresome." "Who was your lunch date?"
"Bendrix."
"Bendrix?" I said.
"Why not Bendrix?"
"He gave me lunch at his club, a horrible lunch." I came up behind him and put my hand on his forehead. It was an odd thing to be doing just before leaving him forever. He used to do that to me when we were first married and I had terrible nervous headaches because nothing was going right. I forgot for a moment that I would only pretend to be cured that way. He put up his own hand and pressed mine harder against his forehead. "I love you," he said. "Do you know that?"
"Yes," I said. I could have hated him for saying it. It was like a claim. "If you really loved me, I thought you'd behave like any other injured husband. You'd get angry, and your anger would set me free."
"I can't do without you," he said. Oh, yes, you can. I wanted to protest. It'll be inconvenient, but you can. You changed your newspaper once, and you soon got used to it. These are words, conventional words of a conventional husband, and they don't mean anything at all.
Then I looked up at his face in the mirror, and he was crying still. Henry, I said, what's wrong?
Nothing, I told you.
I don't believe you. Has something happened at the office? He said, with unfamiliar bitterness, what could happen there? Did Bendrix upset you in some way?
Of course not. How could he?
I wanted to take away his hand, but he held it there. I was afraid of what he'd say next, of the unbearable burdens he was laying on my conscience. Morris would be home by now. If Henry hadn't come in, I would have been with him in 5 minutes. I would have seen happiness instead of misery. If you don't see misery, you don't believe in it. You can give anyone pain from a distance. Henry said, my dear, I haven't been much of a husband.
I don't know what you mean, I said.
I'm dull for you.
My friends are dull. We no longer, you know, do anything together.
It has to stop sometime, I said, in any marriage. We're good friends.
That was to be my escape line. When he agreed I would give him the letter, I would tell him what I was going to do. I would walk out of the house. But he missed his cue. And I'm still here. And the door has closed again against Morris. Only I can't put the blame on God this time. I closed the door myself.
Henry said, I can never think of you as a friend.
You can do without a friend.
And he looked back at me from the mirror, and he said, don't leave me, Sarah. Stick it a few more years, I'll try.
But he couldn't think himself what he'd try. Oh, it would have been better for both of us if I'd left him years ago, but I can't hit him when he's there, and now he'll always be there, because I've seen what his misery looks like.
I said, I won't leave you. I promise.
Another promise to keep, and when I had made it, I couldn't bear to be with him any more. He'd won, and Morris had lost, and I hated him for his victory. Would I have hated Morris for his? I went upstairs and tore up the letter so small nobody could put it together again, and I kicked the suitcase under the bed because I was too tired to start unpacking, and I started writing this down. Morris's pain goes into his writing. You can hear the nerves twitch through his sentences. Well, if pain can make a writer, I'm learning Morris, too.
I wish I could talk to you. Just once. I can't talk to Henry. I can't talk to anyone. Dear God, let me talk.
Yesterday I bought a crucifix, a cheap, ugly one, because I had to do it quickly. I blushed when I asked for it. Somebody might have seen me in the shop. They ought to have opaque glass in their doors like rubber goods shops. When I lock the door of my room, I can take it out from the bottom of my jewel case. I wish I knew a prayer that wasn't me, 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 help me, let me be happier, let me die soon, me, me, me. Let me think of those awful spots on Richard's cheek. Let me see Henry's face with the tears falling. Let me forget me. Dear God, I've tried to love, and I've made such a hash of it. If I could love you, I'd know how to love them. I believe the legend. I believe you were born. I believe you died for us. I believe you are God. Teach me to love. I don't mind my pain. It's their pain. I can't stand. Let my pain go on and on, but stop theirs. Dear God, if only you could come down from your cross for a while and let me get up there instead. If I could suffer like you, I could heal like you. 4th of February, 1946. Henry took a day off work. I don't know why. He gave me lunch and we went to the National Gallery and we had an early dinner and went to the theatre. He was like a parent coming down to the school and taking the child out. But he's the child. 5th of February, 1946. Henry's planning a holiday abroad for us in the spring. He can't make up his mind between the Chateau of the Loire or Germany, where he could make a report on the morale of the Germans under bombing. I never want the spring to come. There I go again. I want, I don't want. If I could love you, I could love Henry. God was made man. He was Henry with his astigmatism, Richard with his spots, not only Morris. If I could love a leper's sores, couldn't I love the boringness of Henry? But I'd turn from the leper if he were here, I suppose, as I shut myself away from Henry. I want the dramatic. Always. I imagine I'm ready for the pain of your nails, and I can't stand 24 hours of maps and Michelin guides. Dear God, I'm no use. I'm still the same bitch and fake. Clear me out of the way. 6th of February, 1946. Today I had a terrible scene with Richard. He was telling me of the contradictions in the Christian churches, and I was trying to listen, but I wasn't succeeding very well, and he noticed it. He said to me suddenly, "What do you come here for?" And before I could catch myself, I said, "To see you. I thought you came to learn," he said. And I told him that's what I meant. I knew he didn't believe me, and I thought his pride would be hurt, and he'd be angry, but he wasn't angry at all. He got up from his chintzy chair and came and sat with me on the chintzy sofa on the side where his cheek wouldn't show. He said, "It's meant a lot to me, seeing you every week." And then I knew he was going to make love to me. He put his hand on my wrist and asked, "Do you like me?" "Yes, Richard, of course," I said, "or I wouldn't be here." "Will you marry me?" he asked, and his pride made him ask it as though he were asking whether I'd take another cup of tea. "Well, Henry might object," I said, trying to laugh it off. "Nothing will make you leave, Henry." And I thought angrily, if I haven't left him for Morris, why the hell should I be expected to leave him for you? "I'm married." "That doesn't mean anything to me or you." "Oh, yes, it does," I said. I had to tell him sometime. "I believe in God," I said, "and all the rest. You've taught me to. You and Morris. I don't understand." "You've always said the priests taught you to disbelieve. Well, it can work the other way, too." He looked at his beautiful hands. He had those left. He said, very slowly, "I don't care what you believe. You can believe the whole silly bag of tricks for all I care. I love you, Sarah." "I'm sorry," I said. "I love you more than I hate all that. If I had children by you, I'd let you pervert them." "You shouldn't say that. I'm not a rich man. It's the only bribe I can offer, giving up my faith." "I'm in love with somebody else, Richard." "You can't love him much if you feel bound by that silly vow." I said drearily, "I've done my best to break it, but it didn't work." "Do you think me a fool?" "Why should I? To expect you to love a man with this." He turned his bad cheek towards me. "You believe in God," he said. "That's easy. You are beautiful. You have no complaint, but why should I love a God who gave a child to this?" "Dear Richard," I said, "there's nothing so very bad." I shut my eyes and put my mouth against the cheek. I felt sick for a moment, because I fear deformity. And he sat quiet and let me kiss him. And I thought, I am kissing pain, and pain belongs to you as happiness never does. I love you in your pain. I could almost taste metal and salt in the skin, and I thought, how good you are. You might have killed us with happiness, but you let us be with you in pain. I felt him move abruptly away, and I opened my eyes. He said, "Goodbye." "Goodbye, Richard." "Don't come back," he said. "I can't bear your pity." "It's not pity. I've made a fool of myself." I went away. It wasn't any good staying. I couldn't tell him I envied him, carrying the mark of pain around with him like that, seeing you in the glass every day, instead of this dull, human thing we call beauty. 10th of February, 1946. I have no need to write to you or talk to you. That's how I began a letter to you a little time ago, and I was ashamed of myself, and I tore it up, because it seemed such a silly thing to write a letter to you who know everything before it comes into my mind. Did I ever love Morris as much before I loved you? Or was it really you I loved all the time? Did I touch you when I touched him? Could I have touched you if I hadn't touched him first, touched him as I never touched Henry, anybody? And he loved me.